It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll find out how UW-Madison students are using photos and social media to start a discussion about race on campus.
First, the U.S. had another big Tuesday yesterday as voters in Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island went to the polls to cast their votes for presidential nominations.
It was a big night for the front runners in both parties, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and businessman Donald Trump.
I just want to thank all of you, everyone who came out to vote here in Pennsylvania and across Maryland and Delaware, Connecticut, Rhode Island.
I just want to thank everybody. This is a far bigger win than we even expected, all five. And that's something that's really...
Clinton won in four of the five states. Trump emerged victorious in all of them.
We're still a few months out from the nominating conventions this summer, and the field hasn't narrowed to just Hillary Clinton for the Democrats. Bernie Sanders is still in there, and on the GOP side, Ted Cruz and John Kasich are still in the game in the hopes of thwarting Trump and forcing a contested Republican convention.
Joining us now is Francesca Chambers. She's the White House correspondent for the Daily Mail. She's also been following the candidates on the campaign trail for the 2016 presidential race. She joins us now to talk about last night's primaries and some news from today. Francesca, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Well, before we go to last night, Francesca, news leaked earlier today. Ted Cruz had a big announcement coming up. Turns out it looks like that big announcement. He has a running mate, even though he's not the nominee yet, Carly Fiorina. So what do you make of this decision now? Usually people wait till they're the nominee to start talking running mates.
Well, after last night's results, Ted Cruz is trying to shake things up in this race. It's become clear that he could not win the nomination outright. He would have to do it on the floor in a contested convention, like you said. However, he thinks that if he has the energy behind him of a running mate or someone like Carly Fiorina, a woman, given some of the comments that Donald Trump has made about women, that it would create some energy behind his campaign, help him in this final stretch, and perhaps convince Republicans to support him at the convention if Trump does not clinch the nomination before then.
Do you think the timing of this nomination, you know, we wake up in the morning, all the news on the Republican side is Trump wins big, bigger than expected, has a realistic path maybe to that 1,237 magic number of delegates that he needs. We've got to change the headlines quick.
There's no doubt that he is trying to grab the headlines after what happened. Not only did Trump win big, Cruz knew this was going to happen. He didn't even bother to campaign in those states for the most part in the final days, staying instead in Indiana where the next contest is next week. So he knew that he had to change the headlines before Indiana votes, absolutely.
And Carly Fiorina, you mentioned a woman. That's something that's maybe worth bringing onto an anti-Trump ticket. Also, a person known not for a political career, but for a business career. Is that something that maybe is an effort to balance out Donald Trump's resume?
Well, having that private sector experience is something that's going to be very important to Republicans who are possibly considering Ted Cruz. But also, she will play the role, as vice presidents have in the past on as running mates on these tickets, as an attack dog. And we've seen from these debates that Carly Fiorina has no problem playing that role. So she'll be able to say things about Donald Trump and about the Democrats and even Hillary Clinton, who's also a woman, that Ted Cruz just wouldn't be able to say without turning voters off.
Well, with anything done to stop Trump at this point in the Republican race, is this too little too late?
He's very close to getting the nomination at this point. It's possible that he will not get it before the end of these contests in June, but after last night, he now needs less than 250 delegates to be able to win this, and there's still 616 delegates available in the race. So as you can see mathematically, it's very possible at this point that this last minute move by Ted Cruz won't even matter because Trump will get the nomination anyway.
Talking to Francesca Chambers about the latest in national politics, including last night's primary results. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of those results? What do you make of Ted Cruz announcing a running mate today before he's the nominee? That's Carly Fiorina, 800-642-1234. Francesca, staying with the Republicans and last night's results. Donald Trump, as you mentioned, expected to win. Not a surprise that he won. He exceeded expectations, it looks like. Why do you think that is?
Well, partially because of what I said about Ted Cruz more or less conceding those states to him, knowing that he couldn't win there, and changing his focus to Indiana, which is a winner-take-all state, where if he can pull off a win over Trump, he would get all of those delegates and deprive Trump of more delegates that he would need for the nomination. So that created room, I think, for Trump to be able to succeed in those states at a rate higher than possibly expected and even indicated in polling.
And I've seen some analysis, Francesca, that yes, there are a lot of people in the Republican Party who want to stop Trump, but a lot of those people might not be real eager to stop him by voting for Ted Cruz instead. He's not, like, at the outset of this thing, he was the one people were worried about in the Republican establishment. They don't, and John Kasich isn't winning delegates, so they maybe Trump's winning because they don't have another viable option out there.
Well, that's been the irony of this election on the Republican side all along, which is that Ted Cruz, not the most liked guy in Washington, and not necessarily the most liked guy by the Republican establishment. And so now, given the choice between him and Trump, because, again, as you noted, John Kasich just doesn't have the delegates to realistically be a player in this at this point, unless it goes to a convention and, you know, everything goes breaks loose and it goes past a few ballots. And Trump doesn't win it on the first ballot. But yes, that is part of what's happening here. And as Trump said, and we'll have to take him at his word, there have been so many folks that are considered part of the establishment who have been coming up to him at this point and saying they recognize he's probably going to be the nominee, and they want to beat Hillary Clinton, so they're ready to get on board.
Well, let's move over to the Democratic side of things now. Hillary Clinton technically lost the state of Rhode Island yesterday, still picked up 11 delegates. So what do you make of her pretty big win? She had some delegate gains, so her lead is bigger than it was going into yesterday. What do you make of her win last night?
Well, Bernie Sanders won Rhode Island, which is the one state that predictably he would win yesterday. It's some tough knocks for him. In Connecticut, he could have done very well there, but Hillary Clinton campaigned there aggressively with the Sandy Hook families even, and that is a state where gun violence is obviously going to be a very touchy and salient issue, and she effectively campaigned against his record on gun legislation, so she ended up winning that state as well. Pennsylvania is a state that the Sanders campaign openly said before yesterday that they were targeting. It had the most delegates to give out, and had he won it in a big way, it could have tipped the scales in his favor for this election. However, he lost very large to her there as well, as polling indicated that he would, and it really made it to where he doesn't actually have a path towards the nomination at this point where he would beat her in pledged delegates. He said today that he believes that he still has a very narrow path, but it's become very apparent just based on the remaining delegate math that he will unlikely be able to beat her in pledged delegates, so he'd have to rely on those super delegates that are supporting her to change their minds.
And his campaign has sounded a little different, and Hillary Clinton talking a little differently now. People saying it sounds like she's now really starting to pivot and look toward a general election. Here's a listen to what she had to say last night at her victory rally in Pennsylvania.
Too many people feel at the mercy of forces too big for anyone to control, and they just worry that those of us in politics put our own interests ahead of the national interest. The faith that we can make things better, that we can give our kids a better future than we had, is at the heart of who we are as a nation.
So, Francesca, can Hillary Clinton really now securely pivot from running against campaign from Bernie Sanders that has really exceeded initial expectations, maybe even his own expectations, and start really running in this general election?
You know, I spent a lot of time working on a story about this today that I encourage all of your listeners to read about how Bernie Sanders supporters want him to stay in this race. They have been disappointed with the tone that Clinton has taken towards them, and they feel disrespected. They're upset by the idea that she's sort of spreading out there that Bernie Sanders should just get behind her and they should just fall in line behind her as the Democratic Party nominee if she is able to clinch the nomination. They don't think that's fair. They think that she should have to work for their vote, and they don't think that she's done that so far.
talking to Francesca Chambers. We'll pop that article she just mentioned up on the Central Time Facebook page. Francesca's the White House correspondent for the Daily Mail with us to talk about last night's primaries and the road ahead.
And we want to hear from you. Were you surprised by last night's results? Do you think it's too early for candidates to choose their running mates? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Again, the number 800-642-1234. Or you can leave us a comment over on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking about yesterday's presidential primaries. Hillary Clinton walked away with more than 200 delegates last night. And Donald Trump won big, getting most of the delegates in all five states.
Francesca Chambers stays with us. She's White House correspondent for the Daily Mail. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is it time for second or third place candidates to drop out of the race? Ted Cruz, John Kasich, Bernie Sanders, should they stay or should they go? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We talked about Hillary Clinton maybe pivoting toward a general election. Donald Trump has been blasting Hillary Clinton at this point in the campaign. An interview with Fox News, he said she'd been using the woman card to get ahead. During his victory speech last night, a reporter asked him to follow up on that. Here's what he had to say.
I think the only card she has is the woman's card. She's got nothing else going. And frankly, if Hillary Clinton were a man, I don't think she'd get 5% of the vote. The only thing she's got going is the woman's card. And the beautiful thing is women don't like her, okay? And look how well I did with women tonight, okay?
So Donald Trump confronting what he calls the woman card head on there, Francesca. What do you think?
Well, if you look at Clinton's exit polls and the poll numbers, while he perhaps inarticulately stated it, Hillary Clinton has earlier in this race actually not won as many women as you would have expected. In fact, Bernie Sanders was doing quite well with women early on, and then Clinton sort of pivoted in her campaign and started to talk more about pay equity and paid family leave and some of these other women's issues that Bernie Sanders had actually been talking about quite frequently as part of his platform. But it's no doubt, though, that Clinton's numbers have obviously improved with women and men and all kinds of other voters as she moved closer to getting the Democratic nomination.
Let's go to our callers now. Alexandra is on the line in Madison. Alexandra, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say your question was whether we kind of anticipated this, and I felt like I anticipated that Clinton was going to do really well in all these states because I think that a lot of it is framed and influenced by how the media portrays previous states. Because, you know, Bernie Sanders won in Wisconsin, which is a swing state. And regardless of who wins there, you know, New York is going to go blue either way. Yet it was portrayed as this really important state to say who should be in the general. And so then I think it really influences and sways future voters into who they think would be good in the general election. And I think that in the way it was portrayed, it influenced towards Clinton because of the emphasis on the New York primary.
Alexandra, thanks for bringing that up. Francesca, you know, Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders won in Wisconsin. People thought maybe this is a momentum booster, but as Alexandra says, they didn't win in New York, and people made a lot of that, partly, I guess, because of the big delegate counts. Did we put too much in the media, too much attention on what came out of New York last week?
Well, the big delegate count did matter, though, because for both of those candidates, they needed those delegates to be able to move on in this and grab the nomination. And it's not just New York. Pennsylvania had a large delegate count as well. And California, very large delegate count, 475 delegates on the Democratic side. It's a fact that Bernie Sanders could not win this election if he does not win the majority of those delegates. I mean, he probably can't anyway, but it is a fact that without California, as his campaign has stated and put so much emphasis on, that he won't be able to do that. So I don't think it's just the media, though I will agree that we do have a tendency to place a lot of emphasis on some of those really big states like New York. It's the campaigns as well. Again, the Sanders campaign is the one talking about how important the state of Indiana is, or the state of California, and every state really that comes along.
Well, speaking of New York and Indiana, Ted Cruz didn't have a great showing last night, as you mentioned earlier, and he didn't really count on much, but he's focusing on the road ahead. Here's what he had to say in a speech last night in a key state for him coming up, Indiana.
The media has told us the candidates in this race, the Republican and Democrat, they're both going to be New York liberals. But I got good news for you tonight. this campaign moves back to more favorable terrain.
A lot of attention, especially from Ted Cruz on Indiana, where he was speaking there, and this deal with him and John Kasich saying Kasich lays off campaigning in Indiana, Cruz lays off campaigning in Oregon, and New Mexico, I think, more Kasich potentially friendly states. Is this deal going to do anything for either of them, Francesca?
Well, to go back to New York for a second and what he just said there, that whole New York values thing, mm-hmm. if we were going to talk about Republicans in New York for a moment, that's what did Ted Cruz in New York, not just the emphasis I think that other people were placing on it. It was that he keeps saying and has said this thing about the New York values, and that sort of thing turns off voters in a state like New York, even if it plays well other places in the country like Indiana. And in Indiana, that is a state where he has to do well at this point because he set the expectations very high, right? With this deal that we're talking about with Kasich, where Kasich supposedly wasn't going to campaign there, although that's sort of up in the air based on some of the things he's done in the last few days. But by making that agreement, it puts Cruz in the position of, if he can't win there, when it is basically a two-man race, because Kasich's not campaigning as heavily, then that's very difficult for him if he loses that state to Donald Trump, because then it says, where can he win?
Well, and the numbers really add up for Donald Trump if he wins Indiana. It's going to be hard to stop him maybe from hitting that majority if he can take Indiana, right? Francesca? I think we've lost Francesca Chambers. We'll bring her back up in a sec. Talking to Francesca Chambers from, hold on just a sec, Francesca Chambers from the Daily Mail. She's on the campaign trail following the candidates, looking at last night's primary results. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is it time for candidates to drop out of the race, people who aren't in first place? Ted Cruz, John Kasich, Bernie Sanders, or should they stay in it until the convention? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll see what you have to say. Absent Francesca now, Brett joins us in Green Bay. Brett, hi.
How you doing? I was just wanting to make a comment that I believe Hillary Clinton wouldn't be doing as well as she is because the primaries are closed to independent voters a lot. In Arizona, there was countless people that were disenfranchised. Their registration as a Democrat were changed to independents. Independents are shut out of this election. And I think if Bernie Sanders should run third party, because when you see an open election, you'll see a lot more people voting for him. But that's all I got. Thank you for taking my call.
All right, Brett, thanks for that call. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the state of the primary right now. Should everybody stay in until the convention? Or should Bernie Sanders, John Kasich, Ted Cruz drop out? What do you think of Carly Fiorina as a vice presidential candidate if Ted Cruz should win? He's announced that today. Looks like we have Francesca Chambers back with us. And Francesca, I wanted to ask you what you're looking at next in this race, apart from Indiana, obviously.
Apart from Indiana, the next big voting day will actually be that June 7th day, where for both sides, Republican and Democrat, that will determine a lot in this race. For Donald Trump, that's realistically the first day that he could get enough delegates to win this nomination. And on the Democratic side, that could be the day as well where Hillary Clinton sweeps a series of states that day and then has enough pledged delegates plus superdelegates, because on the Democratic side at this point, neither candidate could win with pledged delegates alone, but enough pledged delegates plus superdelegates that have said that they're supporting her, that she too will walk into her nominating convention with enough delegates to become the nominee. And everything between there, you know, well, some of it, like we said, in Indiana will get played up. But that's really the first day, that June 7th day, where we'll actually know what's happening in this race.
Bring on another caller now. Richard is with us in Monroe. Richard, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you think?
I was wondering what the difference in delegates, minus the superdelegates, between the two candidates, between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton.
Richard, Thanks for the call. What's the so a lot of people say, oh, when you take out the superdelegate factor, Clinton isn't as far out in front. What does it look like without those superdelegates?
So on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton, after last night, actually extended her lead over Bernie Sanders and pledged delegates significantly. She now has more than 330 pledged delegates over him. So that's why when you look at the remaining races that are left and how many delegates each have, Oregon, for instance, is a state where Bernie Sanders will win, but Oregon only has 60 delegates. So in order to be able to get up to, you know, that 330 gap at this point, he'd have to win New Jersey, and he'd have to also win California.
And those are proportionally assigned. He'd have to win them by a lot.
I know.
Is that right? All right, that was Francesca Chambers. She's the White House correspondent for the Daily Mail. She's been on the campaign trail following the candidates.
Coming up after the news, UW-Madison students are using pictures and social media to try to change the racial climate on campus. We'll talk to some UW students who organized the Real UW Visual Campaign. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, yesterday, the Government Accountability Board voted to request funding from the state legislature for a voter ID education campaign. We'll talk to the director about what this education campaign might look like.
First, a few weeks ago, we talked about the Real UW social media hashtag, an outlet for UW students to share their frustrations with the racial climate at UW-Madison.
Our next guests have added a visual component to the Real UW movement. Regina Stieber and Shannara Raul join us now in the studio. They're both students at UW-Madison and are co-founders of the Real UW Visual Campaign. Regina, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you.
And Shannara, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Well, the Real UW hashtag has been gathering momentum. We've been seeing stories in the media about this, as well as the conversation happening on campus. So why did the two of you decide to add a visual component to this?
So our Chicano Latino class, our 530 class with our incredible professor, Revel Sims, focuses on Latino urbanism, and our professor tells us about how space is created and reclaimed. For our semester project, in lieu of writing a paper, he told us to find our own way to connect what we learn to our own experiences at Madison. There are 8 of us on this campaign, and it just became something bigger.
Mm-hmm. The hashtag we originally had came up with for this visual campaign was RUW. For 2 reasons, and for one of them was that it kind of presents the realities that students face on campus, especially students with marginalized identities, that this is the reality of their UW, and also as a way to reclaim space, saying that we belong here too. But then all of the racially charged incidents started happening, a lot of hate and bias crimes started happening, and the Real UW hashtag came out just kind of organically from the student body through social media, and so we joined on with that hashtag in solidarity with all the students who are experiencing microaggressions and hate crimes on campus.
And I wonder if you could describe it for us. People don't have it in front of them to see, but it's very powerful to read this as a tweet, and then you add the visual component where you have a student and the quote, and it becomes something even more. It takes it to another level. Could you describe what people will see and maybe quote some of what we see on these pages?
So we're looking at microaggressions, and we try to get the student either an ally or somebody who feels marginalized with their identity. We get them to hold a whiteboard with a quote or a statement, something that they've experienced, and we get a picture of them, and we post it on Facebook. And we've decided to use social media as our medium because we've evidenced the impacts of it in the last decade. It's the technological revolution. We've seen it through Arab Spring, and this is our own Wisco Spring of sorts. We're young individuals, and in our generation, we read listicles, we're on our phones, we're constantly connected. It's one of the best mediums to raise awareness, both because it's pervasive and it also fosters dialogue.
And can you share, Regina, some of the quotes that we see on these pictures?
Yeah, for example, some students wrote, you're too light-skinned to be Mexican, or it's because you're Asian, or where are you really from, are like some examples of microaggressions. Microaggressions are really impactful on cognitively and psychologically on the student who receives them. Microaggressions are not necessarily overt, and they may not be intentional, but the impact is still very relevant and still there, and so we want to bring awareness to that.
What do you mean by the term microaggressions?
Yeah, so microaggressions are smaller manifestations of the isms, as you would, racism, sexism, ableism, and the impact of this ism has a huge deal in like conversations, and it makes people feel ostracized. It can make them feel unsafe or unwelcome. And so, yeah, microaggressions might not be intentional or overt, but they are covert and they are still very pervasive in the psychological mindset of the student who is the victim of that.
Jenna, would you say that some of these are more than microaggressions, that there is actual aggression going on in some of the things that are said to students of color at UW campus?
Definitely. The issues on our campus stem from UW as a microcosm, as a smaller version of America. We're saturated with neoliberalism, and the marginalization is somewhat overt, but people in Madison can be liberal but not liberal-minded, and a lot of people feel uncomfortable, and it's kind of a montage that was left in the 60s. Professor Sims pushes us to think creatively, and talking about issues such as race and sexuality causes discomfort, but we need to start pushing buttons and encouraging dialogue.
Yeah. Regina, do you have something to add?
Yeah, microaggressions are important because when people use these words or phrases, they become normalized, and when language or actions are normalized or accepted, they become a culture, and it really adds to the campus climate. And so people are socialized by the dominant culture, and so this campaign was meant to shake up that culture a little bit and start discussion to help people unlearn the culture that perpetuates the xenophobic attitudes and anything that isn't the norm, which is like heterosexual, white, male, cisgender, able.
Were people willing to be part of this project? I'm curious about how you find them, because there is kind of a weird double shaming that goes on where it happens to you and you're embarrassed that it happens to you, mm-hmm. even though you're not the perpetrator. How eager were people to be part of this?
People definitely, the first time around when we put out the event, it was a little hard to get people to come in and join, but I think as time went on, more people, I think it was a collaborative effort that a lot of people felt support from their peers and came forward to share their story or their statements of solidarity.
Mm-hmm. How many people have participated so far, do you think?
It's been over 50. Mm-hmm. I believe our final count was around like 60. We did maybe 2 or 3 weeks of taking pictures, maybe once or twice a week going on Library Mall or going to the Chicano Latino Studies gathering and having people go there if they had time during the day. But we did get a lot of messages of people saying, oh, I wasn't able to come out. Can we meet up privately to take a picture? And so it just shows like there was a lot of support from the student body. A lot of people want to participate or show solidarity.
And a lot of people on Facebook have liked it at the page, both at the school and outside.
Is that how you get to see the pictures? You have to like the project on Facebook?
You don't have to like it. It's all public, but that's one way to look.
We're talking right now with Regina Sieber and Shanar Raul, students at UW-Madison and co-founders of the Real UW Visual Campaign. Real UW is the hashtag where students and faculty are sharing stories of racial bias on campus. And now there's a visual component that we're talking about today as well. And we started this conversation because, Shanar, you were talking about using this as a way to create space. How would you say that's worked out? What kind of space have you created with this?
I think hopefully we created a safe space for discussion, not only on the Facebook comments, but also in classrooms and people giving presentations. You know, we get messages on our Facebook page asking if students can use the pictures in the presentation. And so I think it's fostering dialogue, and that mm-hmm. in itself is important. Hopefully it's done in a safe way. We're trying to keep things very neutral, and we try to be very inclusive in the identities we included in our campaign, because we understand intersectionality is really huge with people's identities, and there's no hierarchy of oppression.
Even personally, I've had friends who normally weren't very comfortable talking about such issues they feel more comfortable engaging in dialogue or asking those questions that and they want to clarify. They don't want to be ignorant, and that's great.
Have you and the other founders faced any backlash? Because I know there has been backlash against students who use the Real UW hashtag. Have you seen that?
Yes, we have. There are some ignorant comments, but I think it just kind of exposes the amount of ignorance that is out there and how much work we still need to do. There's a lot more education that needs to be had, and we're working towards the next phase of our campaign and adding more education on microaggressions.
Definitely. I think there's a lot more support, we'd like to think, and some of the comments we've noticed are generalizations sometimes, and like Regina said, it definitely does show like how the long way that we have to go. We don't want to glorify or vilify or demonize one group over another, because that doesn't make us better than the people who target us.
There has been an ongoing conversation since the hashtag conversation began about how responsive the university has been. Has it been owning up to the problem? Has it owned the problem and taken adequate steps to change? What is your opinion on that? Regina?
Well, we are collaborating with the administration now. I'm not sure if you saw an article came out yesterday, I believe, saying that the chancellor has agreed to implement cultural competency for faculty this next coming semester. I think that's a huge step, and I think they really felt the pressure from the students, especially through social media and through letters and through marches and protests and walkouts. A lot has been happening on campus, and I think they really felt the pressure, and they are now taking action.
What would that cultural competency be, do you know?
Well, personally, there's a lot of talk about an ethnic studies consolidation where they would take all of the individual ethnic studies programs and make them into one big ethnic studies program. And that we don't really support that, just because we like the ethnic studies being different, because it helps not only those who are marginalized but those who are not, because students need a safe space. But also these classes, we're in the Chicano Latino Studies program, and our classes are taught by experts, and they know their fields so well, and they give us evidence of why students need historical context, and so they know what they're saying is hurtful. And cultural competency provides people the ability to provide a better service.
And just very briefly, as we wrap up, what is next, and what are your hopes for this?
So we're in the process of creating a website right now, and we actually conducted a survey, and we were conducting research throughout our entire campaign. So we have the results from that, and we are putting together a website and going to put our research out there, and we're starting to analyze it. It's actually very interesting, our results, and we're going to, you know, just give it to the university and provide it to whoever, you know, may come in handy for. Hopefully they can maybe use it with the cultural competency module that they're creating, but we have been in contact and we're collaborating with administration to include our campaign with the competency that they're creating.
Well, Regina and Shinar, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Regina Stieber and Shinar Raul are students at UW-Madison and co-founders of the Real UW Visual Campaign.
Coming up, we'll talk about the news that the Government Accountability Board voted to ask the state legislature for voter ID education funding.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about the impact of wetlands legislation just signed into law here in Wisconsin.
First, the Government Accountability Board voted yesterday to ask for money from the state legislature to fund a voter ID education campaign. A report from ProPublica in late March critiqued Wisconsin, saying there should have been a public service campaign before the April 5th primary.
Kevin Kennedy is with us now to talk about the decision to ask for money from the state legislature. He's director and general counsel for the Government Accountability Board. Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob.
So what are you hoping to do if this funding comes through to educate Wisconsin voters about the voter ID law?
Well, we would restart the campaign that we had designed back in 2011 and that we used briefly in 2012 and in 2014, which is, we call it the Bring It to the Ballot campaign, really just to raise people's awareness that you need an ID, get them to go to our Bring It .wy.gov website where they can get some more detailed information or to use our toll-free number that we have that they can call if they don't have internet access. There's a lot of complexity that people aren't paying attention. It's hard to pick up right on election day, and so we want people to be prepared and get to that website and get the information. So the purpose of the campaign really is to say, you're going to need an ID, be prepared, here's where you can get more detailed information, because there's a lot of exceptions that people aren't aware about. There's a couple extra steps for students that's different for most people. Most people have the ID they need, but they often don't pay attention to this until right before they go to cast an absentee ballot or to vote at the polls.
We just put this to a test a few weeks ago with the primary. That was the biggest turnout election we've actually had the voter ID law in place for. Did we see confusion among voters on voter ID?
We did see some confusion. On one hand, things went very smoothly. Student polling places were really the most challenging. Part of that is, I think, the nature of being a student. You don't think about this till right before then because you're so focused on your classes and everything else. But it's also a little couple extra steps for students. It's not just that, and they would make assumptions that their out-of-state driver's license was good instead of checking out to see that they could have gotten a product from the university or their private college that would have helped them, but they would have needed two pieces of documentation. So we will, in addition to, getting some more information on radio and news, we will be reaching out directly to the colleges and universities again to do that.
The Government Accountability Board voted to make this request. It was 4-2 in favor of asking for funds. Why did we see that two-member dissension?
Well, this is a politically charged decision. We talked about this back in April. They had a public meeting. The board said, the staff came to the board and said, we now have voter ID. It's going to be in full force for the 2016 election. The legislature gave us money before, but they don't have it in the budget. And the board at that time said, look, the legislature wants a funding campaign, then they need to step up to the table. We did some outreach behind the scenes, and they were just focused on other things, one of them being the dismantling of the Government Accountability Board. And so, again, like the students I'm talking about, the polling place, the legislature starts to pay attention now that we've had an election. And said, oh, maybe a campaign would be a good idea. And we got a request, and the board voted to say, well, we'll ask for the money because, and the dissension really was we had a tremendous turnout even without it, but you have some folks who just weren't prepared, and there is that level of confusion, and no matter what level of outreach we do, I'm sure we're not going to catch all the people that could benefit from knowing what they need to know to be prepared.
Some legislative leaders have said they'd consider this. Governor Walker said, I'm quoting, the fact is the state had to spend a whole lot of time and money defending the law, the voter ID law. And the quote goes on, we continue to do so today. If people were really serious about that, they wouldn't have allowed the state to use all that money to fight courts and to use that in promoting the system. So is there a link between money defending voter ID from legal challenges and money that could have been spent on a public campaign to educate people about voter ID?
No, there's not. That's really a very disingenuous comment. I mean, this was a very politically charged decision in the legislature. Not everyone supports it, and people were challenging the right. That's a whole different issue than working it out, and I don't think that's like apples and oranges.
Talking to Kevin Kennedy, Director and General Counsel for the Government Accountability Board, which just requested funding from the state legislature to get the word out to educate voters about a photo ID between now and elections later this year. Kevin, you mentioned the Government Accountability Board on the way out now. There's a handover going to the new Elections Commission after the legislature changed how our election management system works here. How is this handoff going to work?
Well, we're in the midst of the transition right now. Four of the six commissioners have been appointed by the legislative leaders. The governor has to make two appointments. He's got a Democratic list of former clerks and a Republican list of former clerks. He has to pick one from each list, and then they can go about the business of picking who the new administrator is for the agency. Most of the staff carries over as a result of the transition.
We had a caller, Kevin, getting back to voter ID, saying a lot of people were turned away at the polls because they didn't have correct documentation, and wondering, are there numbers that do we know how many people were unable to vote, were turned away because they didn't have the right kind of ID versus people were able to get that squared away? Do we have stats on that?
We really don't have stats on that, although I can tell you anecdotally, most people, I was at several different polling places on Election Day. I talked to the chief inspectors, and they had only a handful of people who didn't have the ID. And in most cases, what happened there is when I was there, one person didn't have it. She went out to her car and got it. I think the biggest challenge is when you talk about numbers were the students. You know, we saw long lines there because they needed to register to vote. That often requires a separate piece of documentation because they have to prove their residence for voter registration, whereas they have to prove their identity for the voter ID.
So absent this campaign, the money is still in the air. What do you want voters to know, now that you're talking to some of them, at least on the air, about voter ID when they're going to vote in the U.S. Senate primaries this summer or the general election in November?
Well, I think the big thing that we want people to do is, as I've said, you want them to be prepared when they get to the polls. And the best way is to check our website. Go to bringit.wi.gov to find out what's the type of identification that you need. If you need to know where your polling place is, what your registration status is, myvote.wi.gov. Very personalized. You can put in your name and your date of birth, and it will tell you if you're registered. It will tell you your polling place. It will give you the options of who's on the ballot. But I always tell people, don't wait till the last minute. We expect more than 3 million people at the polls in November. That's over a million more than we had in just a couple weeks ago. So be prepared.
And briefly, Kevin, as we wrap up, you have this request in for the legislature to use some discretionary money to educate people. Are you confident? Do you think it's likely that they'll sign off on that?
Well, we'll make the request that the board directed us to make it. As you said, the two committee chairs were supportive in their public comments. Our staff right now is putting together a number of different options that we can do within the amount of money that the board directed us to use. And we'll get that request in very quickly to the Joint Committee.
Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That's Kevin Kennedy, Director and General Counsel for the Government Accountability Board, which for another couple of months administers elections here in Wisconsin. He joined us to talk about the board's decision yesterday to request money for a campaign to educate people about the state's voter ID laws. Yesterday on Central Time, we talked about adult friendships. Turns out we have fewer friends, research finds, as we get older, and it keeps getting harder for adults to make new friends.
And this conversation, it struck a chord yesterday. A lot of you called in to share your stories and your advice, too.
And we heard more over on the Central Time Facebook page from our friends there. Betsy told us, I am a Milwaukee salsa dance teacher, and I feel I have more friends now than ever. I also feel that my students have an easier time making friends because they're participating in a healthy social activity outside of a bar or office environment. Singles, couples, parents, divorcees all come out to social dance. So that's the ticket. Become a salsa dance teacher. I'm going to hang up my shingle right now.
You're going to become a teacher, not just a student?
Yeah, I'm a really good dance. No, I'm a terrible dancer. I think I would drive away friends in droves if they saw me dance,
actually.
Yeah, maybe
pick something else, like
a little less dexterity challenging.
Right, maybe origami? I don't know.
Mime.
We'll keep working on that one. Well, Lynn chimed in as well. She said, join an organization associated with work, go to church, volunteer at a hospital.
And Carol wrote that her husband and her have moved a lot, so moving to new communities, hard to break in with a new group of people. So we want to hear from you. What is your advice? How do you find new friends? What do you suggest for people who have trouble building, maintaining those friendships? Tell us on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.